Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We've come to the end of another school year as graduations take place across the country, but for college students, the cost of that education can be a major stumbling block, and many of the proud graduates parading across the stage with their hard-earned diplomas will leave that stage saddled with considerable college loan debt. The Biden administration has offered several initiatives to lower or eliminate that debt, but Dr. Joyce Payne got a head start on that effort years ago. In 1987, she founded the Thurgood Marshall College Fund, designed exclusively for exceptional students at the nation's 47 publicly supported, historically black colleges and universities. Financing a college education can be particularly difficult for African American students, and the lack of funding is the top reason for dropping out of school. So this hour, we're going to find out more about that fund and the need that it fills. Dr. Joyce Payne is the founder of the nationally recognized Thurgood Marshall College Fund. She is now Director Emeritus of the Board of Directors, and she joins us for the hour. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Michael. I'm so glad to be here with you. I've heard your voice on numerous occasions over the years. And I think it goes back to around 1985, 87, when I started the fund. So you were in broadcast, in the business of broadcasting, when I created the fund in 1987, I believe. Okay. So it's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you very much. Also with us is George Spencer, who is the Chief Innovation and Growth Officer of the Thurgood Marshall College Fund. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you, Michael, for having us.
You're welcome. So, Doctor, the cost of college has been rising for years to the point where it has become a significant challenge for a lot of students and for their parents and for the financially less secure, shall we say. We know that. We know that college debt can be onerous and prevent individuals from fully participating in the economy for years after they graduate. We know this now. You knew it years ago. How would you characterize the economic challenges of paying for college in the African-American community versus the community at large?
Well, Michael, what's important here is to not only look at the debt, which is exceeding $1.5 trillion in terms of student debt, to look at the income and the absence of wealth in the Black community. When we look at some of the Rand Corporation reports, Pew studies, and a number of other research on the issue of student financial aid, you find that the African-American community with limited resources, especially in terms of wealth, is significantly lower than the larger community. We're around 2.9% in terms of wealth versus close to 87% in the white community. So we're talking about income in the area of $24,000 for Black Americans and exceeding $185,000 for white Americans. That's an enormous gap in terms of the ability to send our children to college. And that's why Pell Grants and student financial aid is so important to maintaining access to higher education. But I must say that Black colleges in terms of tuition and lodging has not been nearly as high as some of the other institutions and not increasing significantly. On the average, we're looking at $9,000 to $12,000 for public historically Black colleges and universities versus around $11,000 for the UNCF. Those are the private institutions. And when we look at majority universities, we're talking about an average of more than $42,000. So what we're offering is a significant opportunity to attend college at a lower cost and high quality. We have made enormous efforts to maintain the quality of education at the lowest cost possible. What we also didn't include in the introduction is that we have seven community colleges that are part of Thurgood Marshall now. So we're talking about 54 institutions. Those seven institutions, one is in South Carolina, and the other six are in Alabama. They are probably charging anywhere from $2,500 to $3,000 for a two-year education. And we're hoping that we can strengthen the articulation between those institutions and the 47 we represent. Pell Grant is the lifeline of HBCUs. We're talking about an enormous number of institutions that could not survive without student financial aid. About 76% of our students are receiving some form of financial assistance. And the FAFSA fiasco that we just went through is going to have a disproportionate impact on Black colleges if we can't get it right. And so consequently, Thurgood Marshall will be involved in helping parents and students to better understand FAFSA. We're doing some programs with students involved, with our institutions involved, in helping students navigate the FAFSA form.
I was going to talk about that later on in the program, but since you brought it up, let's talk about it now, because your fund is not the only avenue for financial help out there, obviously, and you've right. referred to that. But one of those sources, allegedly, is FAFSA, which is the Free Application for Federal Student Aid. In 2022, the government awarded about $111.6 billion in federal grants and loans and work study funds, if I have this correct, aimed at helping nearly 10 million students go to college. And this better FAFSA form was designed to make access to that money easier and to provide crucial support to Black students and to HBCUs. But evidently, that's faced a couple of hurdles, some snags, and there are students out there who still don't know how much money, how much financial aid they are eligible to receive. How has that snag and this fund, which was designed to help students, which hasn't helped them yet, impacted their ability to pay for college and your fund?
Well, it's extremely important, Michael, extremely important. You're looking at initially the original form ask about 108 questions. I mean, can you imagine, even our tax forms don't require normally 108 questions or forms to be filled out. We have, or the Department of Education has reduced that form significantly. And that's great. I mean, it's fine that we're simplifying the process. At the same time, the data between the Internal Revenue Service and the Department of Education was incorrect to the extent that the information that parents were submitting was erroneous, did not comply with the eligibility requirements. There were all kinds of problems.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but that was because it was erroneous because they didn't understand what the government Absolutely. Wanted to know, correct?
That's correct.
Because now, the form made it difficult to understand.
Absolutely. I mean, the simplification of the form is ideal, but you know, if you don't get the data right, mm-hmm. If you don't help parents understand what information is needed to be eligible for Pell Grants, then you know, what are we doing?
I think it's analogous to why a lot of people don't do their own taxes, because they don't know what to put right. in the form.
and the Congress passed this law in 2019-2020. I really don't understand why in 2024 we haven't been able to get it right. But be that as it may, we're going to be working with our students, with parents over the summer, with a grant from a foundation based in California to help them understand because it is so significant. We're also seeing a decline in the number of students who are submitting FAFSA forms, because of the complexity and the inability to understand the eligibility requirements. I must say, I'm also pleased, in spite of the problems we're having with FAFSA, that the state of North Carolina has that North Carolina Next scholarship. And the eligibility requirements are much better than the Pell Grant requirements. I think the income level is about 80,000. So students in the state of North Carolina do have some opportunities that other states may not have made available.
So let's talk about your fund, the Thurgood Marshall College Fund. It started as the Black Scholarship Program, which you, I'm going to say helped develop, but I believe it might be more accurate to say that you developed it. How did that scholarship, the original one, begin?
Well, I was working for an association that represented 300 universities, public universities, and I'll try to make this story as short as possible, but I was making telephone calls to raise money for the United Negro College Fund and was under the impression that that fund represented all of the institutions, all of the HBCUs, to find out that it did not represent my alma mater, which is now the University of the District of Columbia, where I did my undergraduate work. After realizing that, you know, I decided that we needed something comparable to UNCF. But it needed to be greater than UNCF. UNCF is basically about development and fundraising. We needed to deal with the policy issues, with congressional issues, with federal policy, that is. We needed to find a way to connect with the private sector. And so I started the fund based on a merit scholarship kind of concept and decided later, after about 2 or 3 years, that we needed to broaden it to include capacity building and leadership and professional development. Of course, you know, we had the blessing of Justice Marshall with the help of a civil rights attorney in the state of Arkansas, Wally Branton, well known in the state of Arkansas and in the country. Wally ended up being the dean of the law school at Howard University, and was ultimately a great friend with Justice Marshall. So with that kind of support, we had to not only deal with merit scholarships, but also with the issue of civil rights and social justice. And as you mentioned earlier, before the show started, with the whole issue of diversity. So today we're talking about a fund that that started with 5 board members with less than $1 million. And today we're talking about $500 million in scholarships, capacity building, professional development programs for students that that are attending the 54 institutions that we serve.
So this started out as the Black Scholarship Program and morphed into the Thurgood Marshall College Fund.
Correct.
But along
Correct.
The way, I understand that you were considering naming it after Barbara Jordan, the Texas Congresswoman who was the first one of 2 African Americans elected to the U.S. House back in the first 2 since 1901 to be elected to the House. But you chose Thurgood Marshall, and I'm wondering why. And I'm also wondering how difficult that was to do, because I read, and this could be apocryphal, I read that the first meeting that you were able to get, and it wasn't easy to get that meeting, was kind of terse. Well, who are you and why are you here, essentially?
Well, if you know much about Justice Marshall, he wasn't the most welcoming person in terms of asking him to get involved in anything outside of the law. And Wally Branton, though, had filed a suit with the Supreme Court to desegregate the law school at the University of Arkansas. And
Let me stop you there, because we're coming up to a break, and we'll finish that story on the other side.
Okay,
we're talking
good.
About the Thurgood Marshall College Fund at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with Dr. Joyce Payne, who's the Director Emeritus of the Board of Directors and the founder of the Thurgood Marshall College Fund, which helps support the education of African Americans, and particularly those attending HBCUs in about seven community colleges around the country. George Spencer will join us in just a moment. He's the Chief Innovation and Growth Officer of that organization. And you were telling us the story before the break, Dr. Payne, about how Thurgood Marshall's name became attached to this fund and the prickly personality that he had when it came to things outside the law, when you came to ask him if he would be amenable to having his name attached.
Well, as I was saying, Wally Brandt, the well-known civil rights attorney, made it possible to get the endorsement of Thurgood Marshall. And I've told this story a million times. I developed about a 10-page document to convince the justice to support the fund. Of course, one of the reasons we selected him, I mean, what better name could you get than a Supreme Court justice, even though Barbara Jordan was very well known and highly respected. But the PR team at Miller Brewing Company and Philip Morris felt that Justice Marshall would be the perfect name for a fund that represented public colleges, because he is a graduate of the law school at Howard University and also attended Lincoln University in Lincoln, Pennsylvania. And so that was sort of the pitch that I made, the fact that he was a graduate of Lincoln, that we had racialized education to a large extent when you talk about separate but equal. And so all of the elements of civil rights and social justice and the power of education were involved in that discussion. But when I approached him with that, he simply said, just tell me what you want and essentially, you know, get out of my office. So we have a one sentence, Michael, and one page that said, I agree to allow you to use my name. We had a dinner to launch the meeting in 1987 in a big snowstorm in D.C., tried to get Justice Marshall to appear, and of course, he refused that invitation. But we knew we had the opportunity at that point to change the world.
And, my, how times have changed when it comes to the Supreme Court. let's. You mentioned two companies that need to be mentioned here, because this fund started in 87 in part due to a $500,000 contribution from the Philip Morris Companies and Miller Brewing Company, with also the support of the NBA. Why was Philip Morris, why was Miller Brewing on board with this so early?
Well, I was working with the development officer at South Carolina State and Albert Smith. And at that particular time, Albert had been very successful in getting a number of students from South Carolina State in internships at Philip Morris and at Miller Brewing Company. So he had a long history of working with them. And so when I talked with him about the possibility of creating the fund, he said, I want to introduce you to one of the senior executives at Miller Brewing Company. And he's from Arkansas. And so there was, again, another relationship between Wally Branton and Thurgood Marshall. And he introduced me to a gentleman who turned out to be my champion, you know, my hope of the future, and that was Thomas Shropshire. He was the highest ranking senior executive within Miller Brewing Company. And that's how we got this off the ground. So Tom played a major role in bringing David Stern to the table, the late David Stern with the NBA. Sony was around at the time as well. And Miller Brewing Company and Philip Morris, and set up an office on Park Avenue, a free office next door to the Jackie Robinson Foundation. And we were off and running with our first interim director. And as I said, with five board members and less than $1 million. And that's how we got started.
That and
our office was on, I should say, our office was on Park Avenue, Michael. And so that's a good start.
It gives you some legitimacy from the get-go.
Absolutely.
I want to bring
absolutely.
George Spencer into this conversation. He's the Chief Innovation and Growth Officer for the Thurgood Marshall College Fund. This all started about 40 years ago, give or take. And since that beginning, you have, as I understand it, awarded over $500 million in scholarships and financial aid since that time. How many people, George, have benefited from that over the years?
Oh, thousands. I mean, if I just look at the you know, the 2023 to 2024 scholarship year, we've awarded 3,500 scholarships to deserving students across the nation. I mean, the average award was about 7,500. Approximately 39,000 students sought out those scholarships. But again, you know, we're on a mission to not only just, you know, generate revenue, but again, reach a broader audience of students. You know, if you're only getting, you know, 3,500 out of those 39,000 that we can actually support, we've got to do more. And so we've been charged with, you know, increasing our capacity internally to build a robust system that will allow us to go out and generate over the next 5-year plan a $250 million goal, which will help us reach a significant amount of more students, deserving students across the nation seeking scholarship and leadership development support.
And you're the person charged with growing this fund and growing its ability to fund more college educations. Where does the money started from Philip Morris and from Miller Brewing and perhaps the NBA? Where does the money come from today?
So we have a large contingent of corporate partners. You know, our primary, funding model right now is based heavily off of a corporate model. You know, hundreds of corporations have come to us as essentially the subject matter experts to help them develop diverse pipelines of talent, to look at equity and inclusion programs that help, again, not only just prepare them for their corporations, but to be globally competitive across the world. And so, you know, if I think about even here locally, I mean, you know, a lot of corporations understand the significance of having diverse a workforce, right? So if you think about the most profitable companies, they will tell you, arguably, that the profit is driven by diverse perspectives. And so we're excited to be able to be at the forefront of providing top tier talent. I mean, this is, you know, talent that just not, it's not ordinary talent. I call it extraordinary talent that that really is making a difference in our workforce and providing the value exchange that corporations are looking for to, again, progress their organizations into profitable models in some of the world's most admired companies.
I should point out that prior to your involvement with the Thurgood Marshall College Fund, you were in the corporate world. You worked both at Bank of America and the LendingTree for a while. Right. Bank of America has long been known for its, or has a reputation for being open, more than open, to diversity and inclusion, and sees a benefit to that, the kind of benefit that you alluded to a moment ago. Dr. Payne has said that the original intent of this fund was to provide the money to create leaders who were both intellectually powerful and who understood how the world works, while providing opportunities for these young people and to elevate HBCUs to provide them with the necessary resources to do that. What are those necessary resources?
Well, I don't know, Dr. Payne, I saw you open up. I didn't know if you wanted to chime in.
No, go right ahead.
Well, listen, I mean, one, you have to keep in mind, we have 52% of our HBCU students are first generation college students, right? But what people don't realize is a large percentage of them are really what we call first generation corporate. And so understanding the essential skill set that's needed to really be competitive in corporate is one of the things that we've really focused on through our talent development programs. I mean, TMCF really bridges the gap between HBCU students and professional employment opportunities with most Fortune 500 companies and government agencies. And you know, we think about even our teacher quality and retention programs that are really preparing Black teachers to ensure that they remain in the classroom. And, you know, research indicates that more than 50% of all Black K-12 teachers are HBCU educated. And so why is that important? Because research also shows that if a Black child has one teacher who looks like them in grades K-12, that this student is 36% more likely to graduate from high school. And so, you know, the preparation goes beyond just corporate America, it goes into the classroom. And so when we think about, you know, necessary skills, we're really focused on developing, you know, soft skills around resume writing, even to get them in the door, interview prep to help them understand, you know, questions and how to be poised within interviews. But even in the classroom, you know, through a pedagogical model, understanding, you know, teacher leadership and how to develop the next generation of prosperous students through teaching.
Many people face barriers along the road to their success, stumbling blocks, but actually in the case of African Americans, barriers were erected deliberately. So from the very beginning, they've long been denied opportunities to build generational wealth. We know all about deed restrictions and redlining that came along in the Jim Crow era, people being denied home mortgages or having to pay a lot more for that mortgage than others might pay in society. And you worked, George, for, as I said, for both the Bank of America and for LendingTree. Can you say that those practices have ended, or are there still vestiges of that lingering out there?
Well, listen, I think Dr. Payne will have much more of a stronger opinion than I will. We probably share, but she'll probably articulate it a little better than me. You know, we've made significant strides. There's no doubt about it. Do we have a long ways to go? Yes. You know, and I think, you know, being here in Charlotte, I think it was 2014 that I see the latest numbers that the economic, social economic mobility for Blacks in particular was ranked 50 out of 50. Which, you know, I think has significantly improved over the years. But you know, looking at it through the macro lens, you know, we have a long way to go. You know, my parents used to say history repeats itself. So, and it's cyclical. And so what we're seeing, you know, through things like the Supreme Court justice ruling, you know, and some of the things that we're seeing around anti-DEI, we're seeing these snippets of history repeating itself. And unfortunately, you know, and this is my opinion for the record, I don't think we are where we need to be. We have a long way to go, but we have made significant strides. And, you know, let's be honest, you know, Black America is doing significantly better in a lot of areas and are able to position themselves, you know, from economic mobility in a much better stance than some of the prior years. But I still feel like, you know, even though I was in technology, let's just be honest, I was in tech and ops in corporate America. I wasn't as close to the lending side, but you can see the snippets of, you know, what was really going on around redlining and those types of things. But again, my simple answer is we've made significant strides, but I don't think we've come close enough.
After 450 years of enslavement and then the Reconstruction and the anti-Reconstruction movement that followed, Jim Crow, et cetera, up to the civil rights laws being passed and the time it took from the laws being passed to where we are today, there's a lot of catching up to do. How does your fund contribute to that ability to catch up to the rest of the pack?
Michael, it's impossible to respond to that question unless we go back and look at the history, as you just alluded to. Our universities have survived enslavement. They've survived Jim Crow. They've survived, you know, resegregation. When you look at the classrooms of America today, we bring students to the campus who have been neglected in K through 12. They aren't graduates of Phillips Exeter in New Hampshire. They didn't get the benefit of Montessori education in the U.S. State Department's Diplotats program, where my grandchildren had an opportunity to go because I was willing to help my family make sure they received a child development education that was worthwhile. Most Black families don't have that benefit. So we have first generation students who have not had the model of an exceptional education. They haven't been bubble wrapped and packaged for the world. And so we have to be in the business of bringing government and industry and business to the table. And that's why I am so pleased that we have 32 corporate members, excellent leaders on our board of directors who bring their ideas, their innovation, their support and resources to the table. Now, as George just said, we obviously have a long way to go economically. some of the cities, some states throughout the country are now taking reparations seriously. As you know, we never got the land. And when we did get it, it was given back to the slave owners. And
yes, we just talked about we just talked about that yesterday, how yes. the 40 acres and a mule, which was never promised, but the 40 acres were promised. And in fact, a number of they've located about 1,250 descendants of the black individuals who were deeded land. They were handed the titles to land in 1865, only to have it retaken away about a year and a half later.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so when you look at land ownership, when you look at redlining, when you look at all of the economic deprivation in Black communities, it's no wonder that we are here today, that George and I are able to be on this program to talk about it. And so it's so important that corporate America and that the federal government see education as an economic imperative.
I have to ask, do they? Because it seems particularly primary public education, let's put it that way, public education seems to be under attack, maybe too strong a term, but it's not appreciated.
Michael, I don't think it's strong enough. You know, we're talking about a voucher system. More money, even in the state of North Carolina, the state legislature is pushing for more privatization of schools. When we're looking at white nationalism in the evangelical community and a number of other Christian communities, we're likely to see even more funds being drawn from the public educational system to private institutions. And so we are getting segregated classrooms again. Segregated classrooms with predominantly white teachers, because black teachers aren't able to go to college, to get the education, to be competitive, to get in the classrooms. And so what happens with a child who has been in a classroom and never seen a model of education, a model of profession?
When we come back, I want to talk about the impact that your fund has had so far, why it continues to be needed, and some of the ways you are expanding the original intent or building on the original intent of the Thurgood Marshall College Fund. We'll do that in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Thurgood Marshall College Fund, which benefits African-American students and HBCUs across the country. Dr. Joyce Payne is the founder of that fund and the director emeritus of the board of directors. And George Spencer is also with us. He's the chief innovation and growth officer for the Thurgood Marshall College Fund, about which you told WFAE's Gwendolyn Glenn last week, doctor, that the impact on students and on HBCUs has been enormous since this fund started in 1987. In fact, you called it life-changing. How so?
97% of our Thurgood Marshall scholars graduate from college. We have leadership institutes where 60% of our students will leave with an internship with major corporations. It is unheard of in any organization to put on a leadership institute with more than 120 corporate, Fortune 500 companies represented, where students can leave either with a job offer or an internship. So when we talk about jobs, when we talk about professional opportunities, when we talk about study abroad, we have open doors of opportunity for our students and open doors of opportunity for our faculty as well. We're doing much more in the research arena to bring our institutions into the forefront through our Center for Social Justice, with support from a number of major corporations, including Novartis and Medtronic, and George can probably talk more about that. But we have 11 universities, one is private, on the cusp of becoming Research One institutions, and that's going to make a difference for our students as well.
You mentioned earlier that you support about 54 HBC, or you're working with about 54 HBCUs right. and junior colleges and technical universities, but not all African Americans attend these institutions. Some attend other schools. So why make this fund exclusive to the students who attend HBCUs and these colleges that you support?
Well, we would certainly love to support every student, whether the student is Black, white, or, you know, Hispanic, whatever the situation is. It would be wonderful if we could open up the arena for all of these students, but, you know, clearly we don't have the resources to do that. I do hope that we will expand in the future to create opportunities for students who are attending other institutions. We certainly get a lot of calls from those students. We get a lot of those transfer students who are leaving high-cost private institutions and attending the public institutions. And so I think that would be wonderful, but Michael, I don't see that in the cards in the next 5 years or so.
George, the need is greater than the, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I just wanted to add, so I'm a bit biased because I went to Norfolk State University. Go Spartans, behold the green and gold. but listen, there's something special about HBCUs. I mean, I just want to be very transparent here. You know, and let's not forget, I mean, the White House published some data years ago that 40% of Black engineers come out of HBCUs, 50% of Black teachers come out of HBCUs. 70% of Black doctors and dentists come out of HBCUs, and 80% of Black judges come out of HBCUs. And let's not forget the first woman in Black South Asian vice president of the United States came out of an HBCU. So so again, it doesn't exclude any students that go, you know, to other schools. I don't want to discredit. I went to Queens University. Shout out to Queens University as well. Here in Charlotte
and Georgetown,
and Georgetown for a program. But my undergraduate experience at Norfolk State was like no other, and I credited a lot of that of my success to that experience.
Let me ask you why? Because these HBCUs were established for a particular reason, and the reason was that students could not go to segregated universities that would back in the early part of the 20th century and into the middle of the 20th century. Now they can. You can go pretty much to any public university you want to at a relatively reasonable cost. Not perhaps to Harvard, because that's expensive, but explain the need, the continuing need, and the continuing contribution of HBCUs in today's world.
Well, I think it's very important, again, to look at the history of these institutions. Michael, we go back to Cheney State University in 1837. Even before we were emancipated, Cheney was in the business of educating African Americans. And so following Cheney, you have 46 other institutions evolving all over the nation. Those institutions were integrated even then. A lot of foreign professors or international professors on our campuses, we've always been diverse. I think that's very important to recognize. But the importance is that we provide an opportunity for students to see other Black professionals, engineers and deans of law schools. We provide an opportunity for students to come to a place where they can identify their heritage, celebrate their heritage, understand the self-expression that's so necessary in a rich culture. I mean, where can you go to walk on a campus where Du Bois at Atlanta University, where I graduated, where Du Bois has given some of his most astounding speeches on the history of Black America? Where can you go, you know, Lincoln University, that at one time was an all-male institution with people like Langston Hughes, and celebrate the rich history of a Langston Hughes? You won't necessarily find that on majority campuses. In addition, you're talking about $11,000 to $12,000 on other public institutions versus around 9,000 on some of our campuses. But it's not just an issue tuition. It's an issue of the rich history of these institutions. It's a history that that needs to be celebrated. I mean, let's look at North Carolina A&T State University. We talk about Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King, but we also have to recognize those students who were brave enough and courageous enough to go into Woolworth and demand that they be treated like every other citizen in the state of North Carolina. And so we have a long history of social justice, and it's important that our institutions continue to celebrate that legacy and to embrace our students in a way that we can move them through a system of education and experience, because this is not just about, you know, educating students. This is also about creating an experience for them. I think it was Einstein who said that that intellect is not just about knowledge. It's about your imagination. And so we bring students to the campus to challenge them to be imaginative, to be creative, to be courageous, to also give back to their communities. And so I am so pleased that when I meet these students, and I met about 30 of them last night who are ambassadors on our campuses, enthusiastic, ready to hit the road, ready to celebrate the richness not only of their culture, but the opportunities that Thurgood Marshall has provided. I don't think you can find that kind of excitement and resilience and dedication and leadership on any campus in the country. HBCUs are known.
I want to cover a lot of territory in the next 6 minutes that we have left to us. So we're gonna speed. This is the speed round of questions, and I want to talk about money for just a second. George, Dr. Payne referenced how much money, on average, it costs to go to an HBCU. You receive an enormous number of applications to be part of this scholarship program. I think 39,000 was the last number I saw, and out of that, you choose to award or have the ability to award about 3,500 of those scholarships at approximately $7,500 a year or $4,700 a semester. That pretty much covers the cost in most cases for these educations at HBCUs?
No, I mean, you know, the cost can obviously vary per state and then, you know, versus in-state versus out-of-state. But, you know, tuition and fees, in most cases, it will cover. You know, again, there are a bevy of fees that go into the education process, right? From from your lodging, to additional books and things that you need to continue to progress on campus. And so, it covers a great portion of that, but there's still a need for more. And you know, what we tell our partners is that, while we're appreciative of the support is that they're giving, you know, what can we do to expand that? And what can we do to grow that? And so we think about in terms of investments or partnerships from partners. You know, it's a great value exchange. It's one thing to get them to school, but to help them get through school, it takes a very, very macro comprehensive plan to do that. And so that's why you'll see scholarships is one portion of it. There may be programmatic support for another portion of it. There may be an internship opportunity for the next portion. So we create this ecosystem that that really gets the student to school and then helps them progress through school through these funding models.
And this fund does more now than it originally started out doing. And I guess that's partly due to your being the chief innovation and growth officer. I'm sure that you play a major role in this. Some of the ancillary things that the fund does, aside from providing scholarships, you engage in professional development training for students several times a year, mainly freshmen and sophomores. It's called DevCon. It's a 3.5-day conference. Are the students you work with in that environment just the recipients of these scholarships, or do you include other students that have not received these scholarships but attend these universities?
Yeah, it's all inclusive. You may have a mix of scholarship recipients, but it's also students that may be introduced to Thurgood Marshall for the first time. DevCon is actually happening, our second DevCon this year in Atlanta. this week. I'm headed there actually in a few hours to kick it off. But again, you know, our purpose is really, again, to help students get to not only to school, breaking the barriers through scholarships, financial barriers, but also get through school. And so we identify, develop, and deploy talent. So if you think of it in those three verticals, that's exactly what we do. We want to make sure, again, that we're identifying that talent that has the aptitude to go further. We want to develop them through, you know, day in life simulations that help students, you know, understand what it's going to take to navigate the corporate environment and then deploy them. You know, want to get them internships, co-ops, whatever we can do to help them get positioned to win and become globally competitive. I'm smiling right now because I just received a message that we received our another 4-star charity rating from Charity Navigator, and we've increased our score from to 99%. That's almost as good as it gets. So that tells you that the partners that we're being great stewards of the finances, receive our operations. That will tell you that our partners are pleased with what we're doing, the work that we're doing, and we'll continue to push forward. But I just received that. I wanted to make note of it. So sorry if I went off script a bit.
No, it's okay.
It's a big deal for us because it really underscores the work that we're doing with our students and the work we're doing internally here at Thurgood Marshall College.
Yeah, there is no script. Go ahead.
George beat me to it. I sent our president, Harry Williams, a note saying your message about the Charity Navigator was right on time. And I'll make sure I mention it because 99% is just phenomenally great. And that's because we have solid leadership. We have leaders that have been around for a while in 40 years, nearly 40 years. We've only had 3 directors. And so we're talking about stable leadership, strong governance in terms of the 32 board members we have. We are extremely frugal financially and always want to maintain, you know, the reputation of being good stewards of the public fund. And I'm at DEF CON here in Atlanta, and I met some of the students last night. We're expecting about 370 students. Most of them are STEM majors, and the majority are also looking at cumulative grade point averages extending 3.2. So we have the best and the brightest here at DEF CON for the professional development.
So again, DEF CON is aimed at freshmen and sophomores.
And
you have a leadership institute for college juniors and seniors, involving them in talking to corporations who may be looking for talent. You also hold this 3-day entrepreneurial training and app development competition, which seems to be right up your alley, George, called The Pitch. It involves about 100 students. And something new, relatively new, Dr. N. Joyce Payne Center for Social Justice, named, of course, after our guest, Dr. Payne. And according to the center, they are focusing on 6 primary areas of concentration: civic participation, economics, wealth, educational equity, future of work, communities and environments, and organizational entities. And one of the distinguishing characteristics of this is not that you don't go in and tell people what is needed. You go in and listen to people tell you what is needed. Why don't more organizations do that?
And that's why we have such gaps in policy, that we don't have the people affected by the policy at the table. And so we want those individuals at the table, as we did a couple of weeks ago with our climate change summit. We had General Honoré. He was the keynote speaker, but we also had Queen Kwek from South Carolina, who is at the table in South Carolina fighting climate change each and every day. We've had a summit on health. We've had a summit on research. We want to bring scholars together and thought leaders to help us frame the questions and address the issues that are confronting not only the public institutions that we support, but also the Black community. I would be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that we did a survey on the essentially the wellness of Black America, and hope to do that over the next 100 years with Gallup.
Okay. I have 1,000 more questions. Unfortunately, we don't have 1,000 more seconds. So we'll have to let it go at that. Dr. Joyce Payne, our guest today, Director Emeritus of the Board of Directors and the founder of the Thurgood Marshall College Fund, and George Spencer, the Chief Innovation and Growth Officer for that organization. Thank you for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.